morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're going to start this program today with a call out to our Chinese friends. Happy New Year. Happy Year of the Dog.
Yeah, right. What was it last year? I don't even like the Year of the Rat and some of the ones they have. I think the dog. Dog's a lot nicer.
Yeah, I don't know how these got named. We should have asked our guest, because our first guest up is
She'd be sure to know.
She would know. Her book is Chinese Soul Food, and what she wants us all to do is not just take out Chinese food, but learn how to cook it at home. She says it's easy.
And Chinese New Year is, imagine it's like Thanksgiving. So everybody goes home and lands on their relatives. and there's a lot of food. They didn't say anything about drink.
We didn't talk about that, did we?
Must be somewhere. Anyway, here's, what's her name?
Cao Qingchu. Well, we're a couple days late for the Chinese New Year, but we're still celebrating, right? I'm talking to Cao Qingchu, right? Did I get that?
Yes.
Great.
Yes, thank you, Anne.
And your
Thanks
book
for having me.
Is a wonderful book called Chinese Soul Food. And you can tell you're a born teacher. you spell it all out.
as somebody who has been a lifelong explainer of Chinese cooking, and then also as a parent, and I teach cooking on the side, so it comes naturally. And having been a newspaper food columnist, that's
right.
You know, as a journalist, you spend time explaining cooking trends and recipes and stories and how people do things. So I really enjoy being able to break things down and kind of meet people where they are and help them understand a different culture.
And if I read correctly, you teach cooking a little bit too.
She does.
I do. So there's a school here in Seattle where I live called Hot Stove Society.
I like that name, by the way.
Yeah. it's a school that's run by one of our most renowned local chefs named Tom Douglas, and he has many restaurants
Tom.
In town.
We know Tom. Yeah, we've interviewed Tom a number of times.
Yeah,
several times.
Sure.
Yeah.
I was just looking at his cookbook, I Love Crab Cakes, which I thought was an odd book for him to write.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we love our Dungeness crab up here in Seattle.
Oh, yeah, right.
But he opened up this cooking school a few years ago, and it's just a fantastic venue for hands-on cooking classes. The equipment in there is just top-notch. So it's a wonderful place to teach and a wonderful place to get connected with a lot of home cooks. And I've been teaching there for the past few years. Teaching everything, mostly pot sticker classes, because that seems to be the most popular subject, and some stir fries, and I've even done some soup dumpling classes, which is kind of hard to make, but people
they're very popular.
They're curious. They want to learn how to make it, and if nothing else, they may never make the recipe at home, but at least they learn why they go out and spend $12 a basket at Din Tai Fung to have soup dumplings. Even if it's just to get a better appreciation for how these dumplings are made,
to put them in the same category that I put the late Paul Bocuse's black truffle soup. I burned my mouth and my tongue so many times.
she's always in such a hurry to eat.
Well, can you blame her? I mean, food is delicious, and you want to eat it while it's hot.
Well, not that hot, though.
Now, as I said, it's so obvious that you're a teacher because you spell everything out. The foreword was so touching from your mother. I mean, you really have cooking in your genes, don't you? Your family had a restaurant.
Well, you know, I think it's more that cooking and food and gathering around the table is part of our cultural DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Because the restaurant business, my parents had no experience in the restaurant business, but it was the kind of the the quintessential immigrant story, which is that we came to the States and, you know, both my parents had been professionals back in Taipei, but they really couldn't translate what they did into their work in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did what many immigrants do, which is start a business. So they had to teach themselves how to start a restaurant, how to run a restaurant, and we grew up in it.
In Kansas.
I mean, we were in Columbia, Missouri, and
I'm in Missouri, not right, Kansas. Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, we ended up in Columbia, Missouri because of the university. But
my parents got
graduate degrees at the University of Missouri School of Journalism. And, you know, so they were professionals and academics. And then, you know, like I said, many immigrants, they end up doing very menial type of work, you know, things that don't require professional certification. And, you know, certainly anybody can open a restaurant if you have the gumption and, you know, are willing to put in the hours. And that's what they did. And my parents wanted a better life for us.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very trenchant storyline now with everything that's going on politically. But we lived through that. You know, we lived through that. It was like they needed a way to make ends meet and raise their family and make a better life. They started a restaurant. So I grew up in that restaurant business. But, you know, so food was very much part of our daily life for that reason. But it wasn't, you know, we weren't in the restaurant business because my parents had a dream of becoming restaurateurs.
Yes.
Yeah.
By the way, your son is just adorable. If that's who that is, is he cute?
No,
very cute. Tom.
Hold on a minute.
And he knows it too. He uses it to his advantage.
Yeah, well, that's like my grandson. He has the dimples too.
There was I thinking that you got to Seattle because your parent and your family came over behind the Klondike Gold Rush.
No, not exactly. I came to Seattle because I was recruited to become the food writer for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer newspaper, which shut down a few years back. But at the time, they wanted to increase their food coverage. So they already had a restaurant critic, and they wanted to have a full-time food writer as well. So I interviewed for that position, and thankfully I got that job. And so I moved here to Seattle in the year 2000 and was the food editor for 7 years. Huh. I left in 2007. So for 7 years I got to play in this really wonderful and rich food culture up here in Seattle.
Oh, there is, isn't
about,
there, yeah.
Oh, it's fantastic. And the seafood is amazing. The oysters and the mussels and clams and the Dungeness crab is incredible and very sweet and meaty. And because we're kind of the main port for all of the Alaskan seafoods, we benefit from the Alaskan fisheries as well. So all the salmon, the wild salmon, Copper River salmon. Everybody knows about Copper River salmon.
Right. You know, can't afford it anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, all of that comes through.
You do a lot of introduction here to key ingredients, techniques, equipment. Of course, everybody knows that the soy sauce I never knew there were that many varieties of soy sauce. You know, to start with, and some of these other ingredients per se, we know about them, but you delve into it so much more deeply than I ever knew was possible. Even though I've done a lot of interviewing of Chinese cookbooks, but you set it all out as something that we should all know.
Well, you know, my book is meant to be very accessible. So I would say that the basic information that I provide in the front of the book related to ingredients is still very surface level, there are other Chinese books out there that go, that have a more comprehensive view. And I think they're so worth, studying if you want to go that deep into Chinese cuisine. There's just so many
there's so many regional specialties.
It was, exactly.
We
yeah,
interviewed
I mean,
somebody.
It was a long time.
We interviewed somebody and I really thought I knew pretty much about the variety of regional cuisines, but I had no idea there's a nomadic Chinese food culture. You know about that?
What's it called? It's such a rich culture, but I wanted to kind of circle back for a second here and say that my book is meant to be very practical, and I want more people to actually to cook Chinese food and not be afraid of it and not be afraid of all the prep work and some of the ingredients. So what my intention was just to try to provide that fundamental understanding of some of these ingredients and how you can navigate them, that selection, and how do you find that in stores. So it's just really meant to be what I'm calling it, an on-ramp into Chinese cooking.
Yeah.
So they can, you know, they can bridge their Western kitchens with a Chinese kitchen, and then if they really, really love it, they, you know, they start getting into the habit of cooking some Chinese food, and then if they really love it, they can explore some of these other books that go way more into depth. So I feel like I just wanted to be that kind of that stepping stone. So that's why I wanted it to be very friendly and approachable, and most of the recipes are pretty streamlined, and you know, even if you didn't have all the equipment, you could still do this food in your kitchen.
But there are 12 different bottles in this picture of soy sauce.
Oh, for the soy sauces? So that was meant purely to make the point that there are many types of soy sauce. In America, you know, we're most accustomed to seeing a couple of brands, Kikkoman being the most common. Maybe they might use a La Choy or one of those mass market brands, and that is totally fine. If that's the soy sauce you have, then that's the soy sauce you cook with. And my intention with showing the variety of Chinese soy sauces that are pictured in my book is simply to say there's a whole world of soy sauces, and if you have the opportunity to try some of these other ones, you should, just to understand that there is a difference. But also just to give people a little bit of an introduction into kind of the depth of soy sauce culture, not just in Chinese cooking, but across the different Asian cultures as well. So that's really the only point I wanted to make there, and not to suggest.
Hold on just a second, Jill. The brand we seem to be focused on is Sanjay, and of all the things, it's made in Richmond, Virginia.
You know, and that's okay. I mean, that's okay.
Yeah, it's very good soy sauce. We really like
it. Yeah, you know, if it's made in a traditional method, which is to say it is naturally fermented and brewed, naturally brewed and fermented, then that's great. It's the you know, like with wine, there is terroir, that kind of the whatever's in the air that can affect the flavor profile of a soy sauce, and that's important. But
yeah,
you've
been to tastings, soy sauce tastings.
I hold them in my classes. So I set out a bunch of different bottles of Chinese soy sauces, and then in my cooking classes, I invite people to come up and they grab a spoon and a glass of water, and they can taste through each of the bottles. And just, all I want them to note is that they taste different.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they taste them side by side, they see how different the flavor profiles are. And if that's all they take away, then that's great. Because then they know, all right, not all soy sauces are the same. And just because I like one brand doesn't mean that that is the only brand that exists, you know. And everybody has their favorite. So you use what is right for you, and then just recognizing that there are all these other options is a step forward. So really, that's all I'm after, is just to kind of, as part of that education, is to help people understand that there's such diversity in basic ingredients such as soy sauce.
Now, I had a question about the Taiwan, because your family escaped from China and settled in Taiwan for a while, right?
Yes.
And we discovered a Taiwanese restaurant near where we live. And it seemed to me that it's a blend of all the different provinces that we encounter, but it's much spicier than I expected, more Sichuan.
Chinese restaurants in the United States tend to offer a hodgepodge menu. It's really hard to find truly regionally focused menus unless you are, in a central, I would say mostly on the coast where there are larger populations of Chinese people. If you're elsewhere in the country, it's harder to find a restaurant that is focused purely on one region, because the customer base is so diverse in what they demand. I mean, we experienced that in our restaurant where, we personally may have favored Sichuan cuisine, but then our customers would come in and they wanted more Americanized dishes, right. Or so there's a little bit of that at play, and I imagine that the owners of this restaurant that you're talking about, they're trying to appease a lot of different types of customers. So that's probably why you're finding some of that variation in the menu. But I don't know this restaurant, so I can't.
Yeah, right. It's not typical of the Taiwanese then to be a mixture of all the different provinces of China and cuisines.
Mm-hmm. And remember, the other thing that's at work is that a lot of their customer base are students at the universities here.
Oh, yeah.
And there are many young Chinese people in Pittsburgh. I mean, there must be tens of thousands of just in our neighborhood who are attracted by the excellent academic programs at the University of Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon University.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this. Were you have certain things in the book, not very many, written in Chinese. I mean, is this published in China, too?
No. This is meant for a Western audience, but, we wanted to have some dishes that we wanted to at least have the titles of the recipes in Mandarin so that those who can read will know what these dishes are.
Well, here's my real question is if this book were received in China, what would the Chinese, the native populations, what would their reaction be? I mean, it would be like, this is real Chinese home cooking, or...
Well, I don't know if I can answer that question because I didn't write it with the Chinese home cook in mind. Mm-hmm. But I will say that my mother's contemporaries are buying multiple copies of this book to give to their adult children who some of them live in the States and some of them live overseas, just as a way to help convey some of these basic recipes. The only chapter in here, the guilty pleasures chapter, has some Americanized dishes.
Yes.
But and that's just a reflection of, I wanted to acknowledge that I did grow up in a Chinese restaurant in the middle of Missouri, and I wanted to acknowledge some of those dishes. There's nothing inherently wrong with those dishes, even if they're Americanized. They can still be delicious. Mm-hmm. But the rest of the book are everyday Chinese dishes that any Chinese person will recognize. Uh-huh. The variations come from the ingredients themselves, because, as you know, ingredients grown in whatever region they're grown in will pick up the flavor of that terroir. So, the Chinese cabbage in China might taste sweeter depending on, I mean, I don't know. The variations come in from the ingredients, and the, you know, the soy sauces, because the culture is there, the soy sauce makers are there. They have that culture that comes up from it. So I imagine that a locally made soy sauce or a locally made chili sauce in the Sichuan province is going to taste much fresher and more pungent because of the peppers there. I mean, so from that standpoint, they'll recognize these recipes, and these are not, I didn't make these up. Like, you know, these are Chinese recipes, and other Chinese people recognize them. They might have their slight, they might have their version of it because their family liked, you know, this ingredient versus that ingredient. But these are real home cooking dishes. This is not, you know, I didn't bastardize these recipes.
You fooled me just a little bit. And because where ordinarily you would find a page number, are those characters, is that the Chinese writing of the dish?
That's the page numbers.
Name of the dish.
Okay. Because I was looking for page numbers.
Here, on the side.
I know, but I found them in a very peculiar place. Oh. I mean, it's not traditional. Maybe it's traditional in Chinese to have the page number on the right-hand side.
It's very nicely designed, Bulk, actually.
Thank you. Yeah, the Sasquatch is my publisher, and the team there did a lovely job balancing, you know, some of the Asian type design.
Making it very clean, contemporary, too.
At the same time. Yeah. I wanted it to be clean. I didn't want it to be too ornate.
Red and gold.
Well, I think that distracts from the purpose of a recipe and a cookbook. Like, you want people to be able to actually read the recipes and cook from them. So I didn't want there to be too much visual distraction from that. So that was something that I worked with the publisher to ensure that we made it very useful.
So now, what about Chinese New Year? Yeah, I mean, I was telling you earlier that my Chinese friends, don't really cook at home on Chinese New Year's. They go out to eat, and we have eating clubs. We have restaurants that we get together in a group for Chinese New Year's.
Yeah, it's easier, you know, just like anybody else, it's easier definitely to go out, and especially for such a big meal, not everybody has the capability to, they don't have the time, or they don't have the desire to make such a big meal for so many people, and sometimes it is easier to go out, and the restaurants are, there's so many restaurants out there, and it's easy to do that. There's nothing wrong with that. What if you don't, though?
I mean, if you're talking about Chinese dishes that are really popular, home-cooked dishes for a Chinese New Year's, what would that be?
So the key for Chinese New Year is, A, you want to bring people together. That's the most important thing. We call the Chinese New Year feast, we call it the reunion feast. So it's the idea that the family members or friends, wherever they are in the world, they come home to be together at this time. So it's a reunion feast, and the components of the dinner, you want to be sure that you include a little bit of everything. So you have something from the sea, something from the land. You have different textures, different flavors. We're more concerned about balancing all of those different elements. And then we put a lot of symbolism into the dishes. So you want to have whole chicken, for example, or a whole duck, a whole fish. The wholeness represents abundance. It represents family. Whole fish represents prosperity. So there's a lot of the Chinese names for dishes are homophones for phrases or words that mean either money or prosperity or good fortune, good luck. et cetera. So there's a lot of these dishes that are a play on words, mm-hmm. and you want to have the whole fish because there's a saying that nian nian you use, meaning that, you know, you have increased prosperity every year. So you have this perpetual good fortune. So you want to have this whole fish. Or you have lion's head meatballs, another dish, where you have these giant pork meatballs that are braised, and you create a broth, and then you put in whole Chinese cabbage leaves. And that symbolizes family. So you want to have this big, happy family together around your table. So a lot of these dishes have those meanings. Anything that is round, dumplings, for example, are rounded, or you have tangerines that are round. All of these, the roundness symbolizes, again, good fortune, good luck. You know, the orange tangerines, it's like, you know, again, good fortune. And a lot of things are reminiscent of money. So the orange color is reminiscent of the gold that used to be used as currency. So a lot of these things, you want to have these foods that represent good luck and good fortune. And then just having the abundance. So it's having this big meal.
Boy, it's huge. The menu, the sample menu you have here. I don't think I could ever get through that one.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, you know, but I compare it to Thanksgiving. You know, Thanksgiving, everybody has a big feast, and they make all these dishes, and it's the same thing. Like, we want to have a lot of different foods, and, you know, importantly, you want to also have dumplings, and that is, sometimes that's a group activity, so you get everybody together, and everybody makes dumplings together, and that, you know, that takes some of that work and spreads it out among family and friends. So yeah, I mean, it's a very festive time of year. It's our big holiday of the year. So
you're having everybody at your house in Seattle?
Basically. both of my younger brothers also live in the area, and they bring their families, and we all gather at my house. And my mother lives with us. So, you know, she presides over the dinner table, and it's wonderful because she gets to see all of her grandkids. And as you know, the grandparents just love that.
Yeah.
So it's good for everybody.
Do you have room for two more?
Say again?
Do you have room for two more? That'd be fun. Although you've made me forever nervous about chopsticks. There's so many things you do with chopsticks that are rubbed. Reminders of death.
Just remember that if you're not using them to actually put food in your mouth, just set them to the side of your plate, and you'll be fine. I mean, you know, and then every Asian culture has a slightly, you know, some of those tips overlap, but you know, every culture has a slightly different list of do not do with your chopstick, but you know, it's a eating utensil.
Yeah,
so if you're not going to put a fork in your hair, why would you put chopsticks in your hair? you know what
I've
I mean?
Never like, seen anybody put chopsticks
yeah.
in their
oh,
hair.
Oh yeah, there's. I've seen women where they'll put a bun, you know, twirl their hair into a bun, and then they stick a pair of chopsticks in it.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't make sense to me. Or people will stab their food with chopsticks. I mean, it's just not. It's not appropriate, but. But, you know, I didn't want to sound threatening, but I just wanted to say, hey, just remember, here are a few tips of what not to do
yes.
with your chopsticks.
Well, I think it's a wonderful book, and I thank you
thank
for
you.
Talking to us about it. It's called Chinese Soul Food, and a friendly guide, and it is a friendly guide, for homemade dumplings, stir fries, soups, and more. And, wow, I mean, it's a great accomplishment when you're working full time and you have the little kiddies and.
Yeah.
So congratulations, Sal Jing.
Thank you so Sal. Much. And I appreciate you, having me on your show.
Thank you. See you in Seattle.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Hi. Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're going to take a quick leap here to potluck dinners.
And well, it's kind of a little bit like Chinese. I mean, they have pot things, right?
I guess.
Whether they have lock in their pot, I'm not sure. Probably they do if it's Chinese New Year, as you just found out.
Prosperity, yes. But anyhow, this book is by Allie Rosen, and it's called Bring It, and it takes you really more than just a few steps ahead of the usual potluck platters that you bring or bowls you bring to pitch-in dinners. Allie Rosen, you've hit on a subject that I think tugs at people who are social and like to eat tart all the time. Your book is called Bring It, and what you're talking about bringing is, of course, potlucks for casual entertaining. And there are so many questions in somebody's mind about what to make, what to bring. You have very, very practical and clear solutions to all that.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that because I think that's the one thing that makes people so nervous when they have to bring something in. And they always end up buying something because they think they can't make it at home, when it's really just starting with the basics and going from there.
There are so many your recipes are really interesting, and we'll talk about those in a minute. But the most useful thing in the book, I think, is I call it the upfront stuff, talking about, I mean, there are specific details that people worry about but don't necessarily ever get direct counseling on.
Like, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that this topic fills a lot of people with dread.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think a lot of it is just about planning. You know, it starts with the mindset of the more information you have from the get-go. If you're planning a potluck, you know, assign people dishes, you know, plan it out. That's usually the biggest thing. And if you're bringing, it also starts with asking questions. You know, if somebody says, oh, bring a dish to a potluck, you might want to have some follow-up questions and say, okay, you know, perhaps is there an oven? What temperature is the oven going to be at? Where are we going to be serving things? Do you have utensils? And I think that that's where people get into trouble because, you know, if you just think, okay, I'll do whatever I want, you know, then a potluck starts to feel like a bunch of disparate dishes rather than, you know, the exciting thing that it can be, which is trying a bunch of different things all together and seeing, you know, how great, you know, what people's favorite dishes are all together.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to end up, if you don't plan it, with all pasta salads.
I think the biggest contribution to the problem, Allie, is when you invite someone to dinner and they say, what can I bring?
Oh, yeah, it's always a million-dollar question.
This is likely to end up in a mess.
right. And you need to, you know, if you're going to have people over, you really do need to start by giving people specificity, because I think no one wants to be that person who says, you know, is dictating to their friends what to do. But I think it's a much better plan to start out by saying, okay, you bring a salad, you bring a dessert, you bring a main. And then from there, then keep a little room for creativity without making it into a mess. And I think that's where you start if you're hosting.
I think if you're hosting, there's one very simple and no-fail solution, which is to send them a copy of Bring It.
I mean, I would agree with you, but, you know, we can't make everybody get it.
There are some interesting things here. I mean, when you're doing this, you need to ask so many questions about, like, I thought particularly interesting was, where will this be served? Location, okay. Location. Because, you know, you don't know. You're going into somebody's house who you may not even know.
Right. And the location is important and the oven is important. I mean, that's the biggest thing. When, you know, when I've had potlucks and people come and everybody brings and they said, oh, you know, can I just heat this up for 5 minutes? I need the oven to be 400 degrees. And somebody says, oh, can I have it? You know, so you really have to plan, you know, the location, you know, are you bringing a trivet? Is it going to be warm? Is it going to be sitting out? Do you need serving utensils? You know, those kind of things. And then if you're going to heat it up, how are you going to heat it up? What's your plan? And have you asked the host about, you know, what they have? Because oftentimes, you know, it could be a little bit of backup and then you end up with a bunch of cold dishes or overcooked dishes, which, you know, so many recipes are really just about getting the cooking times right, and having it warm or cold. And, you know, if you're overcooking something that, you know, you're just starting out from a not great place. I always say my least favorite thing in the world is bad buffet food, you know, stuff that's like sat on heat for hours at a time. And, you know, you really have to think about the temperature. A lot of the recipes in this book obviously are things that are served at room temperature because that's the best kind of dish to bring to a party. So you really want to try to find something that doesn't necessarily have to be heated up, because then you don't have that, you know, potential issue.
But you're also introducing, and you talk about this in your book, a very important issue is food safety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's something that a lot of people ignore. They just think, oh, I'll just stick it out in the sunshine, in a picnic for 8 hours.
Well, that's it, yeah. Of course.
Right. I mean, perfect.
I mean, let me tell you a funny story, and you can adapt this to future use if you like. Years and years ago, Anne and Peter had not met all that long before, but somebody invited us out on their yacht on Port Phillip Bay. The interesting thing about the yacht is the hull of the yacht was concrete.
Oh, wow.
And you'd think, well, that sounds really stable. So Anne made this beautiful antipasto.
Big tray.
big tray with olives. And the first sensitivity to the wind and all the olives went to the scuppers.
Oh, no.
They were rolling around under the floorboards. It was really awful.
Oh, my God. Yeah, well, then for that, you just have to bring your sense of humor because sometimes, you know, when stuff goes wrong, it just really goes wrong.
Yeah, how do people really keep up on the data of what's food safe and what isn't?
Well, you know, listen, I think, first of all, you know, I find that, you know, we all have smartphones, we all have devices. I mean, you know, if you Google, especially, like, temperatures, I mean, I find that even as someone who cooks all the time, sometimes I'll say to myself, oh, goodness, you know, what is the internal temperature that I need, you know, to keep pork at? And, you know, obviously, those types of things are Googleable. But I think it also just comes down to common sense. Like, you know, people get scared about certain things like mayonnaise, which actually if you're buying, you know, a packaged mayonnaise has no issues in it. But then they forget about like, oh, you know, we're going to have like runny yolks in our eggs and we're going to leave that out.
Oh,
so
geez.
A lot of it is common sense. You know, it's milk, it's, you know, meats that, you know, are cooked, you know, to a certain temperature. And it's just not leaving food out too long. I mean, I think that anything that's meat or dairy, you really don't want to put it out until you have to. And so a lot of that is just looking at timing. And then, you know, if it needs to be popped back in the fridge for a few minutes, don't be afraid. I also think that, you know, traveling with the right equipment. I mean, I'm such a proponent of ice packs. I mean, I have
we have a freezer full of them.
Freezer. Yeah, I mean, because, you know, at the end of the day, like, you can buy fancy equipment and fancy insulated bags and all of this stuff. But, you know, most of the time it's just I'm going to stick it in a shopping bag and surround it by ice packs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, instead of worrying the whole time, like, oh, God, am I going to get there in time? You know, just play it safe and get a bunch of ice packs and throw them on. You don't have to buy fancy equipment or fancy bags or even a fancy cooler. I mean, you just want to be mindful of the temperature.
All you need to do is have a joint replacement. and you have all the ice packs you'd ever need.
Exactly. Yeah, a great like side project from that.
Yeah. Now, what are these? You have these plastic storage containers. They look like the ones I have. Are the lids really hard to get off?
No, I mean, so I recommend, you know, for storage, I tend to like if you can find, you know, storage that's sort of a glass or plastic bottom, with a plastic top because they're easier to reheat. You know, if you can get something that's like a Pyrex that has a cover, I find that those are much more useful because people tend to store in sort of totally plastic containers that they can't reheat, and then you find yourself like moving from one thing to the next. So I have found that in storage, it's really great to try and buy, you know, a few containers, often clear, because I think the clear containers always look nice, and then you're not worried about the color clashing. You know, clear containers that are, you know, of some kind of reheatable material that then has an easy to pop on and off lid. Because I agree with you, the lids that you can't get on and off are,
I have those wonderful Pyrex things. They're glass bottoms, and they have the rubber tops with the little vent so you can put it in the microwave.
But they sure are hard to get on and off.
They are hard to get on and off.
Well, you want them to be a little hard because otherwise it's not sealed properly.
Yes.
You know, and there's, listen, like, you know, what's so wonderful about the times that we are living in is, you know, I just saw something the other day for, you know, a plastic cover. Someone was doing a Kickstarter for a new cover that you can put over any bowl. And so, I mean, I love looking, you know, to websites and new, you know, there's so much new stuff out there. So it's really just, you know, test and see what you like because everybody's always trying to find the right thing. I have some friends who love to get really beautifully designed storage things. And, you know, if that's your thing, then great. But just make sure that it has a tight lid and that it doesn't warp and that it can go in the dishwasher. Because the worst is also the ones you put in the dishwasher and then they come out all wonky and you can't use them again. So, you know, it's buy high quality once rather than sort of the cheap flimsy stuff to begin with and, you know, you'll be able to use it for years.
Yeah, it's funny. The ones we get from our, from one of our suppliers, Pennsylvania Macaroni Company, they don't melt. But the ones from Whole Foods do.
They melt in the dishwasher.
They melt in the dishwasher from the olive bar. Listeners, in case listeners, this is a warning to all of you from someone with a lot of experience. Do not use the things that they have at the olive bar because they melt.
They melt. Hey, another thing that I think we should mention, you hit on it, and I think it's important, especially today. It's getting worse and worse and worse every day. People are allergic to this. They're on special diets for that. You know, this one eats fish. The other one eats dairy. The other one doesn't have, wheat. I mean, it's just like, how can you survey? You mentioned in your book to try to find out about some of these preferences and cover this, but how do you survey everybody who's going to be at the party?
You know, it's become a real tricky thing. I mean, I just went to a potluck at my son's school, and they had all kinds of rules about don't bring things with nuts, don't bring things with dairy. You know, I think the main thing is I tend to try and have people bring a couple of sort of main vegetarian dishes that skew on the side of vegan because people who have dietary issues can always eat vegetables. And there's a few, you know, there's a number of recipes in this book that are vegan. There's about 20 or so that would work for that. And I think that then you have all your bases covered. Because at the end of the day, you can't plan a party around one or two people, but you also can't leave people hanging. I mean, it's a horrible thing as a host to have somebody show up and say, oh, here, you can eat this one salad. You're welcome. You know, I think that the best thing is if you're having a larger party, always try to make sure that there's, you know, two dishes that sort of fit into the vegan category because vegan stuff is pretty much safe for everyone. It has no dairy. It has no meat. You know, it only hurts the people who maybe have nut allergies, but you really, you can't win them all. And you also have to recognize that if somebody has a severe allergy, you know, it's kind of their responsibility to mention it to the host.
Yeah,
you know, I'm going to die if I eat nuts. Like, you know,
I'm getting in that category with you. I mean, I really think people don't take enough responsibility for their own dietary restrictions. Now, we have had guests for dinner, people we know very well, who bring their own food, actually.
Surely. Yeah.
Remember the Ravens? They brought, he was only,
Jay Raven
was on the, watching his cholesterol, so he brought his perfectly prepared chicken breasts, skinless and boneless.
Right. So you have to hope that people will do that. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, people are responsible for their own choices. But I think if you're emailing people or you have some sort of communication where you can say, you know, and hey, is there anything that, you know, you're allergic to? And I tend to, this is my personal preference, not say, are there things you don't like? Because then you're opening the floodgates.
Oh, right.
You know, and at a potluck, you can really get yourself into trouble when you start asking people what they do and don't like. But the allergies, you know, you want to be mindful. You don't want to hurt any of your guests. So,
yes.
You know, trying to keep a few dishes that avoid meat and dairy, I think, is usually a safe way to go.
Now, tell us a little bit about your badges.
Yeah, so the thing that I really wanted to do in this book, because, you know, in my role as the host of Potluck with Ali Rosen, which is my show in New York, you know, I'm interviewing people all the time. I'm getting cookbooks all the time. And I find that often I'm flipping through the books. I'm trying to find a certain something, and I can't find it. So this book is broken down into three categories, and you can look for these badges if it's the type of thing that you really need. So one is 30 minutes or less, which is pretty self-explanatory, and, you know, is there to say, like, listen, like, we don't always have a lot of time, and there's nothing wrong with the 30 minutes or less recipes. A lot of them are some of my favorites, so if you're short on time, those are a great option. There's also day ahead is another badge, because I think when you're bringing, often, you know, you have time the day before, but not the moment that you're going. So a lot of these dishes, you can cook them ahead of time and bring them. And the other one is fridge to table, which
right.
means these are dishes that do not require any reheating. You don't have to arrive and do anything to them. They can really be served at room temperature or from the fridge. So those are kind of the things to look for depending on what kind of event you're going to, because it really helps when you're sort of planning out your day or your weekend or your week. Especially, I find sometimes if I'm invited to something on a weekday, you know, I might want to make something 2 days ahead. I might not have time the rest of the week.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of an easy way to flip through the book and find exactly what you're looking for.
Great.
The recipes I looked at, I thought, I don't want, if I made that, I wouldn't want to take it anywhere.
I just
eat it at home.
Yeah, I mean, why? Yeah, I just thought of it again. Now I forgot about it. I don't know.
Good.
I know. What did you say before that?
What did I say before? You think I couldn't remember what I said?
I don't know. Oh, here it is. I got it. Is you are not opposed to shortcuts. You are not a snob. But
no.
The only thing you're really finicky about is fresh lemon juice. I have a system for that, by the way. But anyhow, yeah, my system is I buy organic lemons, scrub them, dry them, put them in a freezer bag, and freeze them. All you have to do is take it out, put it in the microwave for 30 minutes, you've got fresh lemon juice.
But not 30 minutes.
30 seconds, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You've got
I think the shortcut thing is a big thing in this book, you know, because this is really a book that, you know, I'm not a chef. You know, I'm a mother, I'm a cook, and I happen to host a show about food, so I get to learn a lot about food. But, you know, I don't have an entire kitchen full of people helping me to prep everything. So these recipes are really about what's easy for you. And you'll notice on a lot of the recipes, there are substitutions, you know, that'll say, like, okay, if you don't want to make, you know, pie crust yourself, fine. You know, buy it. Like, listen, I think homemade pie crust is way better. However, I rarely do it because it takes so much longer for me, you know. Mm-hmm. And some people find it relaxing. But, yeah, I think there are places that you really can't skimp. You know, lemon juice—it just doesn't have the same flavor. I think
banish is, in fact, when our son went out on his own, and he discovered you could buy minced garlic in a jar. He told me about it, and I cried. I mean, effort is it to mince garlic?
That was the same time you cried when he told you he discovered this thing called
Velveeta cheese.
Yeah, and there are great shortcuts. I mean, even with garlic, you know, you can buy the pre-peeled garlic, and that is so much better than that pre-minced garlic because it sits in that horrible sauce. So, I mean, you know, listen, I think that you do what you can to get dinner on the table. You know, there are times when I am using shortcuts galore, and there are times when I'm thinking to myself, I want to do it right, you know, and when you're bringing food to other people, it really just depends on the circumstance, you know. And so I think you have to figure out, like, what your red lines are that you don't cross. You know, for you it's garlic, for me it's lemons. But, you know, I think that the main thing is that it's better to bring something that you mostly made than to just buy something at the store and to give up, you know. So if that requires you to buy the pre-cut butternut squash, then buy the pre-cut butternut squash, you know. You kind of, I think the best thing is to get in the kitchen and cook and make something your own. And whatever shortcut you need to do that, you know, it's fine. I mean, I have a recipe for strawberry sandwiches where we use whipped cream. And I would never make this recipe myself without whipping the cream myself, because I think that's a pretty easy step. But if you don't have a mixer readily available to you, or you have to pull it out of the top of your cupboard and you just want to buy some Cool Whip, like, the recipe's still great, you know? So I think it's really, like, figure out what works for you and go from there.
Okay, now, I have some recipes that I sort of, I found them and hit on them right away, is the idea of adding shrimp to your deviled eggs. I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah, you know, that recipe, it's funny. When we were shooting the book, we were shooting the photos for the book, my wonderful stylist, Ashton Keith, who, you know, it just made all the photos look incredible. She saved all the, what she called, emotional recipes for the last day.
Emotional.
Because some of these are things that I grew up with that just, to me, are like the greatest things ever. And it was so hard to even share these recipes because they're so personal.
But you grew up in the South, in South Carolina, in Charleston.
I did. I grew up in Charleston, and we had a family friend who made these deviled eggs. And they are just heavenly. And, you know, I feel so, you know, happy to be sharing, you know, my take on her version, because she uses shrimp, which just takes it to a whole other level, and pickle relish, which is really one of those things that is so cheap and easy. And people say, like, well, what do you mean pickle relish? Like, you know, artisanal pickles or something? I'm like, no. Just like the cheap out of the can pickle relish. It adds this kind of sweet, tangy nature to the deviled eggs, but the shrimp are, you know, they're undeniable. Like, they just add something to it, and I think deviled eggs, you know, you see them everywhere. They've kind of become totally ubiquitous, so I almost felt a little bit like, ugh, can I really put another deviled egg recipe out into the world? But I think this one is, you know, it's my perfect version. Whether it, you know, whether it's your perfect version, I guess you'll have to make it and see, but I love it.
Well, we're having shrimp tonight. So we have an opportunity.
Save a few.
Peter likes the standard scampi with the garlic and lemon juice and parsley. And then last time we actually finally harvested our own fennel seeds from the garden. And so I toasted some of those that threw in, and that was, made a big difference. But this cauliflower, I keep trying to figure out what to do with cauliflower. It's supposed to be this hot new trend of about 5 years ago, and I have yet to bake it right.
Yeah, is that the one that has turmeric in it?
Yeah, see, I'm a nut over turmeric. I love it.
Yeah, well, what's great about it is, I mean, the turmeric adds this lovely, subtle flavor, but it also just gives it color. I mean, I think that the issue that a lot of us have with cauliflower is that it doesn't look as appetizing, and I think that's why this sort of whole roasted cauliflower has come into such fashion, because it's one of the few ways to cook cauliflower where people go, wow, that's so beautiful. So, you know, for this book, I really, you know, we also have a cauliflower gratin in the book, and I just really wanted to find ways to use cauliflower because it's so delicious, but that doesn't necessarily have to be this whole roasted cauliflower that everybody seems to be doing. So that salad is just, it's, you know, it's great to bring because it really has some heft to it because it's not just lettuce. But it's also a very simple recipe. You know, it's one of those things where you're roasting the cauliflower, but the rest of it is very simple.
Yeah, I'm dying to try your baked onion, by the way.
That is, you know, I'm very lucky that I get a lot of inspiration from travel. And that baked onion came from this, you know, very formal dinner we had when I was on vacation with my family in Italy. And we sat down, you know, at this beautiful restaurant, and they had all these sort of, you know, extremely elegant dishes. And then they brought this it was just an onion, you know, it's just a baked onion. And I thought, well, what is this? You know, how does this go with the rest of the meal? And it was just so flavorful. And I asked them what they did, and they said, we just cooked it for a really long time in the skins, you know. So that recipe is just
that one, Rabbit. We
onions
that.
And
yeah,
and
we
butter,
can, we can do that.
Know?
Yeah, we
yeah, the butter helps.
Oh, how much
really
butter?
Cool.
I didn't read that.
Yeah.
Lots
yeah,
of butter.
Butter in it. Yeah, I'm
everything
southern,
tastes
so.
Good with butter.
Yeah, I err on the side of butter, but I, you know, that one is just one of those recipes that is so simple to make that you kind of can't believe it. And it's great at room temperature. It's great cold. It's great warm. If you want to heat it up again, you can't overcook it. So it's just, it's one of the ones that I would say, like, you know, you really couldn't mess it up if you were a beginner.
Okay. Again, it's Allie Rosen is the author and the genius behind this book called Bring It, which is essentially potlucks. And there are a lot of things I have to test here, Allie, to see if, in fact, my guacamole doesn't get brown if I take it to it. But it's loaded with information, listeners. And if you're into this new style of pitch-in dining, which is really old style, this is the book for you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate, you know, appreciate your time and having a conversation about Bring It. It's such a labor of love for me, so I can't wait to share it with everyone.
Allie, pictures are great.
It's been so much fun. Thank you.
Thank you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Last one. I love this title.
You do.
Masala and meatballs. So, what it is now we're going to be talking to Asha Shivakumar. Shivakumar.
Who is nothing if not dynamic.
Yes, she certainly is.
Turn your volume down a couple of notches. but it was a whole lot of fun. This is a fun concept, a fun book.
Now, I've been practicing saying this, but I'm sure I'm not getting it all together different. Our guest is Asha Shivakumar. Is that
you
close?
You are perfect.
Good.
You got that perfect.
We didn't realize you were fluent in Hindi as well.
your book is entitled, which is certainly a catchy title, Masala and Meatballs. Subtitled, Incredible Indian Dishes with an American Twist. Now, a little background. You were born and raised in India, right? What part?
I was born and brought up in Bangalore, the southern part of India.
Okay. And then you got married and came to, you moved across the globe to San Francisco.
Yes, I did.
Yes. And now, you devised your own style of cooking and recipes. You started on a blog called Food Fashion Party,
yes.
Right?
And, yes.
But you don't view your cooking as fusion, do you?
I wouldn't call it necessarily fusion, but it is more my take on the traditional Indian recipes. And I just added a little bit of touches here and there to suit my boys, my little boys' palates, and that was the twist that I added. But I wouldn't say it's completely fusion. It's pretty authentic dishes just to suit everyone's palate. A different palate, let me just put it that way, yeah.
They're intriguing. You have not just America, but you have a whole variety of world influences in your cooking. So, I mean, have you traveled a lot or what?
We have traveled quite a bit. Just last probably a year ago, we went to Beijing, China.
Oh, yeah?
We stayed there for almost 3 weeks and ate traditional food, roadside food, fancy food, everything. So I've been to Italy. I've learned cooking this from some of the really nice chefs. And I've been to quite a lot of places. But the funny thing is I haven't traveled much in India. But
right. Now you have a lot of basic information to make this a painless introduction to cooking Indian food with an American twist, right? And you fit it into the pattern of Western eating, as I see. And it, I mean, are you doing courses in here or not? I mean, how are you? I'm just wondering, is this Indian style, putting everything on the table at once? It looks to me like you're actually considering courses, like American style.
So that's pretty much, I think, the American style. Indians just do it family style. We just keep everything on the table. It doesn't come one by one per course. So I think that's what I've learned being in America for so long, bringing out the appetizers first, giving a little bit of a time, and then we bring out the main. So that's, I think that was my take on the American style, yeah.
You do come up with some really amazing things, such as Indian spiced fish tacos. I mean, that's a first.
That's, in fact, something that I created for my boys. My little one is quite a fussy eater. He was, he would eat anything in a taco. So, and all of us would just eat our traditional Indian food, like a fish, how I would make a fish, right? So I just stuffed it in a taco, and he was happily eating that. No complaints. So we didn't have to cook two different things. I just had to put a taco, toast a taco, a little bit of a salad, and it worked, and the recipe worked. So the recipe basically came about just eating, like, say, mac and cheese. How can I make that Indian? How can I make it so that I can add some of my spices? So, yes, I mean, it's all a little bit different here and there, and we enjoy eating like that at home. It's basically, I cook from my book at home right now.
Well, you know, this one has a little bit of everything in it. I'm looking at the recipe for chicken meatballs and noodles in spicy plum barbecue sauce.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Oh, you love that.
Uh-huh.
You love that. I think the barbecue sauce is something, I remember I wanted to add fruits in it because we went to an orchard one day and I had so many plums. And what do I do with that? So I made a barbecue sauce, and I had the barbecue sauce sitting and looking at me, staring at me for a while. And I added it to my meatballs, the meatballs that I learned from my mom. And it tasted divine, and I had to put that in the book. It's a pretty interesting dish, but it's got the tang, it's got the spice, it's also got the sweetness from the fruits. It's absolutely out of the world good. And with some pasta tossed in, so good.
Well, you know, you don't see this in many cookbooks today, is chicken liver.
Yes.
Peppery chicken liver stir fry, which doesn't sound American. It doesn't sound Asian. It doesn't sound Indian. What is it?
So it is an Indian dish. It's an authentic Indian dish.
Really?
Chicken? Yes, absolutely. South Indians make chicken liver quite a bit. So it is a South Indian pretty traditional dish. And I remember making it for parties, just a little bit of a different thing for people to try out who are pretty interested in trying different things, right? So I remember putting out in a party once just with toothpicks. It really turned out well. The people who have never eaten liver, and they liked it, and the people who are used to it also enjoy it. So yeah, it's a pretty traditional, authentic South Indian recipe.
Yeah, if you remember, sweetheart, when we were at that great restaurant in London called Amaya, they had liver on their menu, and I said, I've never imagined that liver was something that was part of the
Indian
the Indian heritage, but they said it certainly was. It was, by the way, absolutely delicious too.
It was. It was very good.
Yeah, and you should definitely try out that recipe. It's a pretty traditional, my grandma's recipe, and she used to make so many things. All the meat dishes that I have in the book is pretty much my grandma's recipes. So that's
pretty
traditional. You
want to
try that out, too.
You said she cooked 3 elaborate meals a day for as many people as showed up.
Oh, my God, she did. She would cook up a storm. We were probably around, 15 to 20 of us at home. It was a joint family. And we enjoyed enjoyed eating. The whole family just enjoyed eating. We would look forward to it. And all of you were pretty special.
Of course, we know that Southern Indian cuisine favors breads pretty well. But you take it a little further, and you have here tomato, garlic, chicken, naan, pizza. So it's pizza now. And here's another one that I find, I can't envision this one at all. Pizza pockets with spiced asparagus.
Oh, my goodness. That's an amazing one. Yeah, that's one of those. So asparagus was not found when I was growing up. So asparagus is something. So the twist over there is it's got Indian spices with asparagus and pizza. And so I learned to love asparagus after I moved here.
I see.
That's a pretty neat
Especially
one.
California, right?
Exactly. We did some of the best asparagus. Yeah, and then just a little bit. Just toss it a little bit with some spices. And they taste divine. Stuffed with the pizza. It's like a pizza pocket. So good. So good.
And I find this one fairly arresting. Three bean salad with boiled peanuts. That's the boiled peanuts come from the U.S. South, not Indian South, right?
In fact, that's another dish inspired by my mom. And that's a traditional, another traditional dish that we make during festivals in South India. Yeah. And we add peanuts to it.
Well, you know, we did interview, I can't remember her name, an author who wrote My Two Souths. And it was, she lived in the south of the U.S., and she came from what country in Asia?
Was it? She came from India.
India. I thought it was India, too.
She came from the same part of the country as you do.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Awesome.
Just down the road from where Anne's good friend Floyd Cardoz.
Oh, right. He's in Goa.
Who was from Goa. Well, Kerala's south of Goa, going towards the pointy part.
Uh-huh. Well, he's a geographer by training, by the way.
Oh, wow. Okay.
This is why I can use terms like the pointy part.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Have you ever ventured into London to eat Indian food?
You know what? That's one of those places I'm looking forward to go. I haven't gone there.
You absolutely should. I mean, there are several Indian restaurants in London with one star and saying they think they should have more. So it gives you an idea of the quality of what's coming out of London Indian kitchens.
Wow, I need to go there.
Yes, you need to go there.
Chutney Mary, we've been twice. It's huge. Really huge.
If you decide to go, let us know and we'll give you a couple of key contacts to make sure that you get to sample the right things.
I'd love that.
In fact, funnily enough, the restaurant Anne just mentioned, Chutney Mary, they have another restaurant called Vareswamy, and then they have five or six restaurants called Masala Zone.
Interesting.
And they're really popular.
Yeah, we took our grandkids there.
I'll definitely get back to you guys when I'm going to go. Yeah, we're planning a food trip very soon, so let's see if that happens. But I'll definitely remember.
Great.
Well, here's a sign of your trip to China, chicken soup with vegetable stuffed wonton.
Yes.
Yeah, it looks like a Chinese dumpling. Yeah.
It's just like a Chinese dumpling, but we have something called the momos from Nepal. We're neighbors, and momos is so popular in India. It's exactly like Chinese dumplings, just a little bit thicker. Mm-hmm. And I took that version, added some spice again, of course, with vegetables. And the chicken soup is a very traditional South Indian soup. So the amalgamation just works. It just works. The two just work.
Put this one on the shelf where it's handy.
I want these hand pies.
Yeah.
I can't wait for you guys. You need to make something and let me know, though.
Indeed.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today. And
thank you.
Be in touch with us by all means.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Asha.
Yeah, thank you so much. You all have a wonderful day.
You certainly can't complain about the variety of guests you get on the Menu Radio. We hope you'll join us again for more variety again. Same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.